Let me just remind everybody, you're listening to WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida, your true community radio station. And stay tuned for another edition of your Weapon of Mass Destruction and Instruction, The Surreal News, which is coming right up. All right, so we're dying to get started because we got a special show. My co-host is Lou Larini. I'm Steve Norris, and Lou is going to tell us what's going to happen on today's show.
Well, first off, we're very happy to be joined here by Dennis Plews, who has just recently received the patent for an impulse drive, sort of a star drive engine. He's going to tell us about that. And later on in the show, you know, with our sort of, I guess, creative theme today, Steve, we're going to have Denise Cowell, who is the founder and creative director of the Chalk Festival, to talk about this year's Chalk Festival, which is going to be held in Venice.
That should be very interesting. All right. And just let me just also mention, good morning, Dennis.
Good morning, Steve. How are you doing?
Dennis also has lots of other talents, so we're going to talk about things other than his invention of the star drive, impulse drive, this morning. All right, so we like to do some underreported news items. Harper Lee, what do you got to say going on?
Well, you know, I'll tell you what, before we get to Harper Lee, you know,
what
I really wanted to talk to you about, you know, first is, remember a while ago when we had the ACLU on talking about those license plate readers and how the ACLU was concerned about what was going on with that information and how certain, you know, police departments were, whether they were cataloging it or saving it. Well, apparently the DEA now is using those license plate readers to take photos of U.S. driver's documents reveal. The ACLU publishes DEA documents that show the license plate scanners also record humans as face recognition helps government be, quote, even more sure of exactly who they are surveilling. The Drug Enforcement Administration, is in the U.S. as part of an official exercise to build a database on people's lives. According to these DEA documents published Thursday, just yesterday, by American Civil Liberties Union, the agency is capturing images of occupants in the front and rear seats of the vehicles in a program that monitors America's travel patterns on a wider scale than previously thought. The disclosure follows ACLU's revelation last week about the potential scale of the DEA database containing the data of millions of drivers, which kindled renewed concern about government surveillance. Edward Snowden let us know about, you know, NSA and metadata and the zillions of records of our, you know, emails and phone conversations. I find this a little more frightening.
Yes. Do not ignore this. Metadata is important. Where you are and who you're with, regardless of what you say, is still very important data
that
can be used against you and et cetera. All right. What's the craziest state in the nation? Well, that debate goes on. Is it Texas or Florida? All right. So the debate goes on now. A Florida Congressman, Alcee Hastings, said in a hearing this week that Texas is the state of crazies. Of course, Texas objected to that. Daily Show had a piece on that. All right. So his example was that a person who possesses six or more obscene devices or identical or similar obscene articles is presumed to possess them with intent to promote the same. In other words, one of their cities has a law that says women can only have six dildos in certain size of things. If that ain't crazy, I don't know what is. All right, what do you guys think? Texas versus Florida, what's the crazy state?
Well, you know, they do keep trying to outdo each other. And North Carolina, though, keeps coming in there doing some pretty crazy stuff, too.
I spent a few months in Texas after my combat tour. And so I got to know Texas a little bit, and I agree that they're nuts. Back then, if you got caught with one marijuana seed in your car and they literally would vacuum your car, you would get life in prison for one seed. Mm. That was a little crazy.
That is true. That is true. I've heard that story, too, and scrupulously avoided ever driving through Texas when I was in college.
Well, we'll keep the report card going. Who's crazier, Floridians or Texans? I'm not sure myself, but I think the battle goes on.
Well, you know, you got to look at the two states who they've elected as governors. You know,
well, that's a tie.
Yeah, there you go.
Rick Perry and Rick Scott, I'm telling you. And okay.
All right, the golden muscle. This is a organism you're going to tell us about.
All right, we will do that.
Did you want to do that one next? I'm sorry, am I getting you out of order here?
No, I was just going to do that. Then I was going
to
come back
to Harper Lee.
I'm just kind of excited that there is going to be, you know, it is in fact the sequel. It is going to be published as a sequel to To Kill a Mockingbird, which is one of my favorite books. I've read it probably about 20 times. Every once in a while, I feel like I have to really read it to get grounded again. She's a beautiful writer, you know. And as we talked a little bit before, you know, it was originally intended to be this particular book published first, even though it takes place after in the timeline of To Kill a Mockingbird, and there was supposed to be a book in the middle that she never wrote. But the really interesting thing about this story is that the manuscript had been written. I mean, Harper Lee, by the way, is like 88 years old. She has macular degeneration. She is able to read, but with a gigantic magnifying glass, according to this story. She loves C.S. Lewis. Apparently, that's her favorite. But they found this manuscript underneath an original manuscript of To Kill a Mockingbird. Her was it her agent or her attorney found it, and she was just tickled to death. She didn't even know it was around. So they're gonna publish it. It's titled Go Set a Watchman, and from what I understand, it does in fact take place after To Kill a Mockingbird, when Scout is older and comes back to their little town to visit Atticus, and this is during, I think, you know, I guess to make a current reference, around the time of the movie Selma. You know, it's what it seems like. I mean, it's around the time when the Civil Rights Act is being proposed and promoted and battled over, I guess, in the halls of government. So it should be very interesting. And we actually, though, need to. I know there's
new
there's
stuff
like,
coming.
There's like there's
new
like,
old stuff.
But we do have some unfunded stuff, Steve.
Well, the next thing I want to talk about was deregulation bills.
Deregulation bills.
Okay. Yes. So the GOP now rammed through two new deregulation bills. So, of course, deregulation is bad, as we have our oil pipelines bursting all over the country. Of course, they're promoting the Keystone Pipeline, like nothing's going to happen.
Right.
Nothing. What could possibly go wrong there? All right, so let's do some more deregulation. Now we're talking about in terms of the financial sector here. So what could possibly go wrong there in the financial sector? Nothing. All right, so the House Republicans this week, two new bills designed to undermine environmental and financial regulations, both jammed through by the Republicans. All right, so one of them, for example, Wednesday, rejuvenates an unfunded Mandates Reform Act of 1995. Which Gingrich brings back old Newt Gingrich stuff. The 20-year-old legislation imposed to, which is this is the host of cost benefit standards, which pushes them on federal regulators, sort of like we were talking about last time about sort of the voodoo economics, and so it adds a new dimension by law, allowing detailed regulatory calculations to be challenged by federal court, which opens up a stage of analysis. We talked about this last time, litigation that makes it nearly impossible for agencies to write and implement new rules. And to make it insidious, the bill is funded by $32 million cut in the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau. So here we go. Cut regulations funded by cutting the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. A double there, which is, of course, created by Obama to try to crack down on the predatory lending and mortgage abuses and unscrupulous credit card companies. All right, so the quote is, both of these bills are part of an attack on the entire regulatory system They're designed to make it impossible for agencies to fund. No Republicans voted against it, but there were 9 conservative Democrats that voted in favor of it. So these kind of cost-benefit analysis are always subject to some type of challenge, but now we have these new regulation cost-benefit analysis coming in, kind of voodoo economics, which are going to and other new rules here to try to undermine regulations, environmental, and in the economic, in the financial sector as well. Pretty scary stuff going on at the House.
Just going back to the Wild West, Steve.
Hey. All right, what do you want to do next? I keep trying to segue
you
in.
I think it is time to talk about the golden muscle.
Okay.
That is just, according to Brazilian scientists, a great threat to the Amazon River. The world's mightiest waterway, the Amazon, by the way, is threatened by this diminutive foe, a tiny mussel invading from China. Since hitching its way to South America in the early 1990s, the golden mussel has claimed new territory at alarming speeds, plowing through indigenous flora and fauna as it has spread to waters in 5 countries. Now scientists fear the invasive species could make a jump into the Amazon, threatening one of the world's most unique ecological systems. This golden mussel, which commonly grows no more than an inch in length, is a hardy breeder reproducing 9 months a year by releasing clouds of microscopic larvae that float with the current to new territories. They attach to hard surfaces like river bedrock, stones, man-made structures, and even each other, forming large reef-like structures. They have devastated, apparently, native clam species by attaching themselves to local mollusks and sealing them shut. Their ability to clog pipes has forced operators of hydroelectric and water treatment plants in Sao Paulo state of Buenos Aires in Argentina and elsewhere to spend millions of dollars annually to clear them out with chemical drips or shut down turbines to scrape out giant mussel formations. This sounds scary.
Our most powerful glues come from mussels. That's where some of the research has come from.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. They can attach to you. Think about it. You're a little teeny mussel in the big ocean. Yeah, I got a pretty powerful glue.
Yeah.
To stick. Yeah. Nature. They're pretty smart here.
They're great steamed in white wine too.
All right. Had some good mussels this weekend. Anyway. Another GOP lawmaker wades into the rape debate. All right, so we have more GOP here putting their foot in their mouth here. So this is yesterday, said that women who become pregnant from sexual assault should not be exempt from anti-abortion measures because childbirth resulting from rape is beautiful. That's his quote here.
But so, I thought the body shut down.
Well, that was the quote from Aiken. Remember that quote from Aiken? So that's later on in Susan. So that quote here, which is relevant to this article, is, if it's a legitimate rape, he said, the female body has ways to try to shut the whole thing down, he said, of the pregnancy. But let's assume that maybe it didn't work or something. I think that there should be some punishment, but the punishment ought to be of the rapist and not of the attacking child. And therefore, they think that rape should not be an exception to the anti-abortion rule here. I said, obviously, rape is awful. What is beautiful is that a child could come from this.
Beautiful
things from rape here.
Like legitimate rape. Isn't that an oxymoron?
Yeah. I think that even more quotes from these folks here. I think that even when life begins in that horrible situation of rape, it is something that God intended to happen. Well, okay, you're a man. How about if we get a woman's opinion? So we have committees with no women, no Democrats, just old white men, Republicans, telling everybody, because they know better than everybody else, what to do, what women should do with their bodies, etc. And then quotes like, if it's a legitimate rape, the female body has ways to try to shut that whole thing down. Well, guy, we're medical people here. There's no medical basis for anything you're saying. So my suggestion is shut up and read a textbook or let somebody who has science. We have some very stupid Republicans thinking that they know about science here. You stupid guys, my suggestion is just shut up. try listening to women or people that know what they're talking about here?
Take a class.
Now, you want to know how I really feel?
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll get Planned Parenthood to come in. We'll get
Barbara
Trevecki to come in and really say how it is. All right, where are we going next?
Okay, one last story. You know, and I just have to say this. I mean, I thought this kind of stuff only happened in the movies, but apparently some Asians are really good at martial arts. Three Albanian gunmen met their match when they held up three Chinese contractors, only to be outwitted and overpowered by the karate skills of their would-be victims. The Chinese contractors reenacted for Albanian News 24 TV on Monday what they had said happened on a mountain road in northern Albania on Sunday after they were held up by gunpoint. Quote, "They were masked and armed and stopped us, putting a gun below the chin of our friend. They wanted our mobile phones, money, and the sacks with our goods," said one of the Chinese men. Speaking in Chinese, the three agreed to fight the attackers, he said. The man's demonstration of his techniques for the camera included powerful hand blows and frontal and back kicks. Having overpowered the gunman, the Chinese men called the police and had them arrested. Albanian police confirmed that the gunmen had tried to rob the Chinese nationals, and they arrested two people aged 21 and 23. And they also seized, I guess, an old Soviet-era model 54 guns and a mask and bags. Holdups apparently are commonplace in Albania during the Balkan countries' turbulent post-communist 1990s, but are much rarer now.
And when is the movie rights to this coming out?
You know, I mean, you know, the bulletproof monk, he lives.
All right, you're listening to WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida. We're your true local here community radio station and your weapon of mass instruction, the Surreal News. And we're going to go right to our guest who's sitting in the studio with me, and that's Dennis Plews. Good morning to you, Dennis.
Good morning, Steve.
All right, so Dennis is a friend of the radio station. His wife is Eve Plews, who has a great show. No Nonsense Nutrition, and her show is?
It's Mondays at 9 a.m.
Which is a fabulous show. Keep you awake listening to things about nutrition anyway, but this show is not about that. It's more about you. So Dennis has a very, very significant and interesting background. You're a vet. You're with the Florida Vets for Common Sense.
Correct.
You're a lawyer. You have your own private practice. All right, so tell us a little bit about your background growing up, because that's kind of relevant to where how we're getting to your star drive, your impulse. For your Star Trek fans out there, we're going to talk about your patent for an impulse drive. But let's get to that by start telling about a little bit about your background.
Well, I grew up in St. Petersburg, as did Eve. We grew up about 5 miles apart. Didn't know each other until she moved to Sarasota. But as a child, I was fascinated by scientific matters. You know, sci-fi was the big thing back then. And my father had been a radio and radar technician for the Army in World War II, and he had his own business, so I was always in the shop with Dad helping with electronics. So I got very interested in science and had planned initially on becoming a scientist. Finished school, went off to military service, came back, and decided that the law was a good place for me to be. I didn't want to be a doctor anymore. And I went into law, but I kept with the science background and the fascination I had with it that started actually in my teen years. So when I got out of law school, I went back to science, started practicing here in Sarasota, and immediately picked up reading science journals, Scientific American, and ultimately became a member of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, joining their Physics A and B branches. Which is nothing more than paying the dues and reading the magazine and participating to some extent in the activities of the organization, but mostly reading. So since I graduated law school, Florida State, I've been studying physics and astronomy. In fact, helped form the local group of deep sky observers here many years ago, and it's still alive and well and still providing sidewalk astronomy events for this community. So my scientific activities have been community-focused. Astronomy has been it, and we've brought our telescopes out. When Comet Halley was in town, we had thousands of people come look through our telescopes and things like that. And we still, throughout the winter months, we skip it in the summertime, it's a little too hot and mosquito-y, put out telescopes for the community to see and do public education. Well, all these things led me to continue my education in science, not only informally but formally. I actually went back to school after becoming a lawyer, after starting my own firm, getting it going, had time then to go back to school and study mathematics and astronomy. Not to any great extent, but did went back to MCC, actually, and took their courses. And then one day I got asked a question about a ringer, an old ringer-style washing machine that walked across the floor when I was out of balance. And that got to me thinking about, actually, Newtonian mechanics and things like that. And as a result of that thinking, I just thought, well, maybe I can make something out of this if I can figure out a way to make it work in space. To convert what we call angular momentum, spinning weights. Tie a weight to a ball to a string and spin it around, you're creating angular momentum. And you feel the pull on the string. And that centrifugal force wants to go away from the center. And the pull of the string on the ball is called centripetal force, wants to make it come towards the center. Well, I figured out a way how to play with that and turn it into an impulse drive.
Yeah, I guess one way I think about this, and I've sort of thought about this too, is if you take a gyroscope in your hand, spinning in your hand, and you turn it in one direction, it gives you force in a direction actually 90 degrees opposite to that.
Well, that's torque. That's a little bit different than angular. It's a relative of it, okay?
Right.
But that's a torque effect to the spinning weight.
Gotcha.
So along the axis of rotation, you have a resistance to being twisted.
So tell us a little bit. So you use some of these principles, but not the torque for your drive?
No. This is just basically it's a ricochet. You can see it in work. I put up a website, stardrivepropulsion.com. stardrivepropulsion.com.
Yeah, it's a good video. It's a good visual.
Well, there's a couple of videos on there, one that explains what it is, and then there's the video of the very first attempt I made to create an impulse drive device. I call it the Mark I version. But in that video, you can see the thrust masses going over basically a speed bump. And it explains on the website what that's doing, but it's sort of zen. It's sort of like the one-hand clapping. Everybody else that ever tried this, all they've managed to do is create a buzzer, an oscillation device. The alarm bell. Brrring, that's an oscillator. And this one, we only get the one ding and not the second ding. And you can see that happen on my website at Star Drive Propulsion on the thrust demonstration video, how it works, under the tab, how it works.
All right, so bigger picture here. So you have some idea going about how you see this washing machine creeping across the floor, right? And you get some ideas. All right, so then how do you get from there to now you have a patent for a device, right?
That wasn't real easy. I also, before I really started going down the path, as a lawyer, I've been a lawyer for a number of years. I hire experts all the time. And I get their advice on particular topics that are relevant to the case I'm handling. Well, I did basically the same thing here. I knew a guy with a PhD in physics. I said, I got this idea. Let me bounce it off your head. We talked about it, and he basically said, well, it could work. What you're thinking could work. And then I took it from there. Because the trick is avoiding this thing we call the oscillator. If you have an oscillator, you're not going to go anywhere. That's what the washing machine was. The weight was oscillating back and forth, but it was banging on one side harder than the other, and that's what gave me the clue. So I had to figure out how to just have the bang without the bounce back. And again, you can see that in the video. Convincing people that it actually worked, particularly the patent office, because they're very difficult. They don't buy the story, okay? So I got advice again from a patent lawyer. Build a prototype, demonstrate that it in fact works. So I did. Well, apparently that wasn't good enough either, because at stardrivepropulsion.com you can see the proof of concept version. It's made out of plastic, built by a 3D printer, right out of the computer model that we created first. So the story was, I built the metal one first that you see in the thrust demonstration video. Then I went to Elisa Fitzgerald, a local engineer here who does CAD, computer-assisted design work. Got with her, figured out how to make it better. We built it in her computer, ran it in her computer. It worked there. From there, we did the physical model. Built the physical model. Had to figure out a way to test it. Well, it doesn't produce a whole lot of thrust, so we got to make it easy to move. So I put it on a boogie board, put it in her pool with an electric motor and a battery to power it, and it crosses the pool. Well, at that time, that was what I was told would be sufficient. But the first patent examiner said, nah, that's not doing what you say it's doing. It's ratcheting against the water. I'm going, ratcheting against water? Good trick. Particularly since it changes directions. But that's another story. So I had to do further proof. So I did the mathematical analysis. So I post the mathematical analysis on the website. For math freaks and physics freaks, you'll understand it. But basically, what I'm doing there is showing where the energy is flowing. Where is it coming from? Where is it going to? So I did that, and I did the mathematical demonstration. And then I showed them that video that you can see on my website of the first version. And we had to go before three senior patent examiners to explain to them why the first patent examiner got it wrong. Well, the three senior patent examiners got this understood better than the first one did. And I think when they saw my video of the Mark I version, that convinced them that, well, seeing is believing. Once you see that it's doing what I'm saying it's supposed to do, then they believed it, and I got the patent. But that wasn't the most exciting thing that happened in patent land, because I needed to be able to produce more thrust. Because what I really want to do, when I was growing up reading science stuff, I'm reading all this science fiction, Isaac Asimov, and all that sort of stuff, and getting into the Star Trek show was coming on at that time. So I said, well, maybe I want to go to space. So at any rate, that was one of the criteria, that this had to produce thrust in space. The first version doesn't produce that much, but I figured out a way to increase its output really a lot. So I sent that patent modification in to the U.S. Patent Officer just within the last 6 weeks. And really quickly, they sent back a form saying, basically, this thing looks like it's going to be really big for aeronautical and space transportation use. Were you working for the government at the time? Because if you were, we want it. So I had to send them back a little statement saying, no, I wasn't working for the government. But the important thing is the modification that I've just come up with, I call it EMMA, Effective Mass Multiplication Apparatus. If you got an hour or two, we can talk about mass and what it is. But let me explain it this way. Everything has an aspect called mass, and we every day in the world consider it as weight. You try to lift something up, it's heavy. But you can push it horizontally easier than you can lift it, like a car. Anybody can push a car. Put it in neutral, push it, it'll go. You're dealing with mass. Try to pick it up, you're not going anywhere. You're dealing with weight. Weight is mass being accelerated by gravity. So I figured out a way to create a mass without mass, Emma, and they sent me back this holy cow statement saying, were you working for the government when you came up with this good idea?
All right, let me comment on my view of what you just said there, and that is, first of all, you have a propulsion drive system that does not have an exhaust. So when you think about rockets and you think about propulsion and you think about jet planes and you think about airplanes, they're either pushing air out the back or they're pushing gases out the back or they're pushing flames out the back. But this propulsion drive does not do that. There's no masses leaving this drive that then get spewed out the back. And the drive itself has no emissions, and it works by moving basically weights, masses around in a clever way in a closed system that then propulses, uses that drive in a particular direction. Correct so far?
That's correct. And you're exactly correct on the hot rocket and jet exhausts and the air blast from propellers from airplanes. And cars themselves also produce thrust. Everything that moves has to do so by way of thrust. In a car, your engine spins, it turns the drive shafts, it spins the drive wheel in your car, and it pushes against the ground. And that push against the ground is the thrust that moves your car forward.
Now, if... just to take this one step further, okay, so the car is different because the car can push against the ground,
right.
So the car doesn't need to have an engine with exhaust to work.
Well, it's still got exhaust, but it's not being...
Yeah, the exhaust is not part of the propulsion. The exhaust could go up or forward,
it doesn't matter.
The exhaust is not part of the propulsion system. However, in space, it's different.
Well, in a rocket or a jet, the propulsion is the hot exhaust gas going out the back, which is created when you burn the fuel.
And you need that in space because you don't have the ground to push against.
Exactly, or air. To fan against.
An impulse drive has to have nothing to push against in order to propel you forward.
Well,
however, you still need to supply energy to make it work.
Right. I call it thrust in a box, just add motor.
Right.
So you add a motor to this box, and away you go, because it generates thrust internally. And if you're hooked onto it, you're going to go with it, just like in the boogie board scene in the pool.
Yes, yes. I think...
I just have a quick question. I just have a quick question. So in other words, what you're telling me is that this thrust in a box, the calculation of the amount of energy that you have to apply to the box is less than the thrust created.
No, it's not. That would be violation.
Okay.
That would be a violation of the first law of thermodynamics. It's going to be more efficient. That is to say, the amount of energy put into it, you're going to get more back out of it. For example, if you're driving a stick shift Mustang and you've got a 225 horsepower V8, you might get 190 horsepower of thrust out of that.
Okay.
So you lose a lot of horsepower in the drivetrain.
Okay.
It's mechanical. It has friction.
Yeah.
There's gears. That turns into heat in the way you go. And Star Drive doesn't have a drivetrain. You put that at the back of your engine, and you skip all the weight and all the frictional aspects of a conventional drivetrain and just go. So it should be much more efficient. We should get better fuel efficiency.
Yeah, that was actually, you jumped on exactly why I asked that question.
Yeah.
Because I thought it was going to be in violation of the laws of thermodynamics.
I know that.
If you could put a certain amount of energy in one side and come out with more on the other side, it's like that's a perpetual motion machine.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like...
No, that's going to work.
Different stuff.
Yeah. No, there's the human laws that I've made my money enforcing for a number of years now as an attorney and a member of the Florida Bar. And then there's the laws of physics that are actually... you can't break them laws. It ain't going to happen. There's not even a loophole.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about Kickstarters and money for a minute here. And you're not, of course, this is a nonprofit radio station. And let me just mention, we're just a little bit past the hour. This is WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida, true community radio station. Dennis Plews is in the studio telling us about his Star Drive, his impulse drive that he got a patent for. And we're going to talk a little bit about Kickstarters and how, if you want to donate to a nonprofit, which is Kickstarters, you're welcome to do that, but we're not promoting this as part of the radio station or for yourself. So tell us about some of the money aspect about this.
Well, once you've done the proof of concept phase, I analogize that to the Wright brothers' first airplane, the Wright Flyer. That worked really good. It flew for about 107 feet, but what's it good for? So the Wright Flyer was a proof of concept version. It worked. Showed the principles to be correct. The next thing they had to do is build a plane that they could actually use for something useful in the world. So that's what we call a prototype. So right now, via the crowdsource funding site called Kickstarter, which you can access through stardrivepropulsion.com, we have a link right there, so you can click on the link. I'm trying to raise the money to build the world's first full-scale prototype of Star Drive propulsion. I intend to build one that you can slide right into a car and use it as a demonstrator. So right now, I and my engineer, Lisa Fitzgerald, here locally, Andromeda Technology, are plugging our invention on Kickstarter.com to raise the $350,000 we feel is going to be needed to build the full-scale, first actual
usable in today's world, put it in your car and go home with it, a prototype of star drive propulsion. And the second one is going to be used, hopefully, to take a pop up to the moon, grab a few rocks, and come back.
Yeah.
That's my big goal, is to get to the moon and just with a robot, a drone. We won't be able to send people with it yet, not for a while. We need a bigger version. But I would love to just send a little plane up there with a high-definition video cameras on it, send video back the whole time, and I think that would be a lot of fun.
Yeah, personally, I guess my view of this, and we're sort of getting to the end of this again with Dennis Plews, we're sort of wrapping up our segment here about your patent for an impulse drive, is things in space and maybe for flying machines, and et cetera, that the use here, because you have a type of drive that does not require throwing things out the back or pushing on ground to go. You can use this in free space, which is unique from other types of drives that we know so far up until now either require have to throw something, some mass out the back, or you have to push on some mass to get you to go forward to achieve thrust, whereas this is different. You're achieving thrust internally through the device. Would you say that's a correct
way
of looking at this? And that's
exactly
the revolutionary breakthrough of this particular, which has, well, if you think about it, if you can then take that, I'll just give you some ideas, just what I've thought about. If you can take that to the microscopic level and take a nano version of your drives, then the possibility you could actually get a lot more power if you could get a nano version of the impulse drive, because then, okay, anyway, something to think about. Big, and you can think about really small here.
Let's put it this way. The smallest electric motor I've ever seen has been on the nanometer scale.
Yes.
Nanometer scale.
That's where things
20
are going.
Nanometer stator.
And my experience with things in life has been the smallest engines, like your muscle, which are teeny, teeny, tiny, basically Velcro things, give you the most power and the most efficiency. Well, if you look at the muscles, a very efficient engine in terms of how the electron goes down the electron pathway eventually to the lowest state, whereas if you drop electrons too quickly, it's less efficient. Anyway, just getting to some physics.
You're talking
stuff
actin, myosin, fibril bundles.
Correct. And the way to build efficient things. Life turns out to be very efficient engines, and that's
well, Mother's been working at it for a long time.
Exactly. Well, I'll give you a second here, and I just want you to, again, just remind people if they want to get, obviously, we're just scratching the surface here. So if you want to see a really cool video and get some more information about this, tell us about your website, and then anything else you want to tell us about, we'll give you about 30 more seconds.
Well, again, the website is stardrivepropulsion.com, on which you'll see the full story, how it started, why it started, how I figured it out, and what it took to get a patent, and what's coming next. And what's coming next is a new way to get around no matter where you are on the planet. And space tourism is going to be the big thing in the future. You can start planning now for a trip to the moon.
Indeed. And you'll go there with Dennis Plews' Star Drive.
Exactly.
Impulse drive.
The only way.
Yes. All right.
Literally.
Thank you so much, Dennis.
Thank you.
Once again, WSLR, let's listen to a Media's Matters Minute, and then we're going to go to the Chalk Fest with Denise Kowal coming right up. Don't
Kovar.
Touch that. Say it again.
Kovar.
Oh, thank you. Okay. Don't touch
this
that.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Coleman Lowndes. After ISIS released a graphic video showing the horrific death of a Jordanian pilot, Fox News' flagship news program, Special Report with Brett Baer, aired graphic footage of the execution.
Tonight, we are going to show you some of the images ISIS has put out. The images are brutal. They are graphic. They are upsetting. Having seen the whole video, it is something you cannot unsee. Horrific and barbaric, as well as calculating and skilled at high-tech propaganda.
Fox News received widespread criticism for airing the images, including from Fox News media critic Howard Kurtz.
I disagree with the Fox decision, and here's why. ISIS, I fear that many of us in the media are helping ISIS spread its propaganda using its fear tactics.
Chris Wallace, host of Fox News Sunday, also voiced his dissent.
We know that there were able to recruit through these videos, and I don't think we want to be part to anything right. that leads to the recruiting of more crazies to go over there and support them.
Although Fox News only showed graphic photos of the execution on television, they hosted the full ISIS video on FoxNews.com. For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
And Media Matters is a nonprofit out of Washington, D.C. You listen to conservative misinformation and report it to us. You're listening to WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida, True Community Radio Station. News and Public Affairs, your surreal news show, your weapon of mass instruction, and Lou Larini is going to introduce our next guest.
Yeah, we are really happy to welcome Denise Cowell, the founder and now creative director of what has to be one of the coolest art exhibits to happen in this very culturally attuned area, the Chalk Festival. Good morning, Denise.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
This is great. First off, Denise, you know, I want to, you know, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and why you started this exhibit of transitory art drawn on the street with chalk.
I know, it is a little puzzling because when I held the first chalk festival, I had never even been to a chalk festival. I didn't know any chalk artists, and I'd never even seen a chalk drawing before in person. So, but somebody had recommended it to me. I mean, I am from a family of artists, and I'm an artist myself. So the reason I created is, you know, I'm a stakeholder in the Burn Square area, and I wanted to create something that was culturally rich, that, you know, supported all the things that are important to commerce downtown and bringing awareness to the area. But I also wanted it to be something that the residents also felt like it was something that created a sense of place. And, you know, that's pretty much what it has done. It's been a wonderful experience, you know, to be able to create something like that.
Yeah, you know, I mean, isn't there like sort of a rich history of like chalk street art? I mean, in Europe, don't they do it all the time? Or
oh yeah, I mean, yeah. You know, obviously drawing on things dates back, you know, before even recorded time. But pavement art, you know, has a very rich history in Europe, you know, from the 16th century, and so it's really blossomed over there, and they're the ones really responsible for bringing this art form alive and keeping it alive, you know, after World War II, when so many of these street artists were you know, perished in the war. So there's a place in Italy called Grazia di Cortone that started the very first, you know, pretty much important street painting festival in the world, and it still is a very important historical festival that takes place. That's all around images of the Madonna and, you know, very religious-based events. So they did that, and I was actually the judge there, you know, for a few years. I've traveled there. And then our festival over the past several years has become the most important pavement art festival in the world for contemporary art. And it's actually an American, Kurt Wenner, that invented, you know, the 3D illusionistic, you know, street painting that now has become so wildly popular in the past 20 years.
Wow, yeah, that is really interesting. Now, isn't there also some sort of monumental significance to the event this year, which I guess is going to be in Venice?
Yeah, we actually, well, this past year what we did for 2014, you know, on top of moving locations, which was quite daunting,
okay.
We also...
We can talk about that later.
Yeah, we also decided to break a world record. You know, as I said, Kurt Wenner invented the 3D illusionistic pavement art, you know, back in the 1980s, and it's a title that has never been held in America. You know, it's been held, you know, in Netherlands, and the past record was held in Germany, and we just felt, you know, hey, we need to secure this record at least one time on U.S. soil, where Kurt Wenner is from, you know, the inventor of it, and so we put that together. You know, I think I came up with the idea in late September of 2014, and by October 31st, we had artists flying in from all over the world and put together a team of volunteers and local artists and lots of sponsors, and we were able to spend 11 days at the Venice Airport attempting to break this world record. So We were successful at creating a 22,700 square feet painting that is an illusion of a megalodon shark kind of coming out of the pavement.
Wow, that's amazing. And I guess the official name is the largest anamorphic pavement art.
That's the official title, yeah, that we were going after to break a Guinness World Record. It really is. There's many things that this painting is. It's the first time that any oversized anamorphic painting has ever been created that included, you know, incredible detail. So, for painters out there, you know, we do cross-hatching, which is a very typical kind of bringing the brush in two different directions, you know. So the whole painting has that throughout it. And we did lots of details because if you walk around the painting, you will have walked a quarter of a mile. So we thought, okay, if people are going to walk around this painting to see how big it is, we wanted them to have an experience the whole time they're walking around it as opposed to just seeing, you know, big splotches of paint. We wanted it to act, you know, to look interesting. And so the detail on this is, you know, I'd be surprised if it gets matched anytime soon.
That sounds amazing. Now, you know, if someone wanted, I mean, was this open to the public? I mean, could people go and view this?
We opened it up to the public. And, you know, next year we actually are going to have the festival, out there as well, you know, where we did open it up this year for 4 days for people to see it. And it was kind of funny because we actually went to view it recently. And it is airport grounds. It's a fairgrounds. It's still, you know, with the airport authority. So I don't recommend anybody drive there and just try to go see it on their own without letting somebody know that you're on the airport grounds, which is what we did. We kind of went into this one area, my photographer and I, just to see how it was doing. And, of course, we were swiftly escorted off by a police officer.
I'm just curious. I mean, how high up do you have to be to get, like, sort of the full effect? I mean, when you're, like, standing ground level and you're looking at this thing and it's, like, 22,000 feet long, I mean, you know, you don't really get the full effect, do you? Or do you?
Well, we actually did the perspective point at 15 feet up.
Okay.
So we built a platform that people could climb up on and view it. And that's where, you know, we obviously were doing the filming and stuff, you know, as the piece got progressed along. We took time lapse. And actually this afternoon, that's one of the things we're going to show. We're going to show a 20-minute documentary on the making of the Guinness World Record at the Venice City Hall. So we're going to be showing that around 4:30 for people that, you know, want to come and kind of see what went into creating such a massive painting.
That's amazing. You know, is that going to be posted anywhere?
We'll probably post on Facebook as well today, and we'll probably do a blog posting on our website today as well. We have sent out notices, obviously, to, you know, the major sponsors and people that were very closely involved in it. But anybody is welcome to join us, you know, at the Venice City Hall Council Chambers, and it's going to start at 4:00 and go till 6:00, and we're going to have a celebration, you know, talking about this record attempt and what went into it. A few of the artists will be there that helped on it as well.
That's great. I just want to remind everybody we're listening to WSLR 96.5 FM, and this is Denise Cowell, the founder and creative director of the Chalk Festival. Okay, so this year's event, where is it going to be held? I know the original ones used to be held around Burns Court, you know, because as I had said earlier in a conversation we had, you know, I used to go to the movies. We do go to the movies a lot at Burns Court, and I remember seeing it there. But
yeah.
Where's it going to be this year?
It will be in Venice again. When I moved it last year, I moved it permanently, as long as, you know, Venice will embrace the event, you know, that's where it's going to stay. And they did fully embrace it. You know, I had the mayor, one of the fundraisers, we did a drag queen bingo. The mayor even dressed up in drag for us, and so did Mike Bachota from Sharky's Restaurant and a few other people down there dressed up to help us raise money. And not only did they do that, but they were out in, you know, our parking lot, and they were parking cars, you know, the entire day. So, you know, I've never had that experience where, you know, the mayor and the different council members were, you know, intimately involved and they volunteered, and the city manager would call me several times a day and ask me what they could do to help with it. The police department was phenomenal. The fire department came out and even brought the truck out so that we could see the artwork on different levels. And, you know, they really embraced it for what it is, which is a community event. You know, this is entirely volunteer. The artists are even volunteering their time to the community. And so they really got that, you know. And for some reason in Sarasota with our elected officials, the community got it, but the elected officials never really embraced it as a partnership. And year after year, it just made it more difficult to perform in Sarasota.
Okay. Sarasota's loss, Venice's gain, I guess. Where specifically now in Venice is it?
Well, this past year we were in three locations.
Okay.
This year we're probably going to have to focus just on the airport because there was a little mix-up in some of the scheduling. And prior to us knowing it, another major event had already secured some of the space downtown. So we can't really move our date because we are an international event and there's a lot of events around the world that kind of function around us. So we have to keep the date. So right now we're going to be out at the airport, and then we're working on securing a location downtown for the next couple months to see how that's going to go.
You know, what I'm curious about is, you know, where the artists come from. Is this like sort of a juried show where artists submit slides or, you know?
Yeah, you know, for the first few years, we did a call to artists, and I certainly reached out. And, you know, like I said, I traveled to Italy and other places to meet many of the artists. And so for a few years, we did that. We stopped doing a call to artists because the festival at this point is so widely known worldwide that, you know, we get over 1,000 applications a year from all over. And every year we try to bring in artists from different countries that we haven't brought them in before, in addition to the ones that we always bring in. So, you know, we're bringing them in from, you know, Italy, Germany, Netherlands, Japan, Colombia, Ukraine, Russia, you know, all over the place. So this year we had, you know, a few new ones. I think it was the first time we had somebody from Colombia. We had some new people from Brazil that we never had before. Somebody from China. So, you know, it grows every year. It's the only festival where the top artists from around the world get together one time. And this is the festival they all get together, you know, and are able to, you know, see each other's techniques and learn from each other, and which is wonderful for our community because we allow anybody to participate for free, even if you don't know how to draw, you know. So we have a very big, diverse group of artists, but anybody can be chalking along with these major artists and really excel in, you know, learning different techniques and skills. So it's a great event that way. It's really one of the only one type of events of its kind worldwide.
That's interesting. You know, now I guess, you know, these artists that come, they don't exclusively work in chalk. I mean, aren't a lot of these artists work in other media also?
They do. Yeah, I mean, a lot of these artists are in museums and do, you know, major installation stuff. But I'll tell you, this art form is really growing. A lot of them, this is their full-time job. This is all that they do. They make anywhere from, you know, $500 for a small job up to, you know, $100,000 for a few days. So this isn't, you know, it's not child's play. Like some people think that it's, you know, like, oh, you know, it's, you know, an ephemeral art form. It just kind of comes and goes, and they're doing it as a weekend little hobby. That's not the case. Many of my artists, you know, there's times that they can't come to the festival because they just have too big of a job that's been offered to them, and they're traveling the world. You know, they're in Dubai, and they're, you know, working for kings and, you know, different princes in different countries and doing phenomenal PR stuff for big companies. So it's a very viable, wonderful business for artists. I highly encourage, you know, artists locally to you know, hone in on their chalking skills so that they also can be people that travel and be able to, you know, get some of these jobs, because it's growing in leaps and bounds, this career.
A quick question about the chalking technique. I mean, we've all seen people, you know, like paint with oils or paint with acrylics or sketch or draw on charcoal. I mean, to get the kind of detail and I know the stuff that I saw at Burns Court was astounding. To get that kind of detail with chalk, how do they do that?
Well, like I say, many of these artists are very skilled artists. But I have to tell you, I have a lot of artists that started with me that were beginning just in their art career. And, you know, after 7 years of doing the festival, art is like anything else. If you practice it, you're going to get good at it. Even Kurt Wenner, who is a master, and everybody, you know, considers him the chalk god, he even, you know, in college, he went to RISD, and they told him he's never going to learn to draw figures. He might as well give it up, and he's not, you know, all this kind of stuff. And, you know, here he is, you know, one of the foremost, you know, painters of the human form, you know. So it's just like anything else. If you practice, you're going to get great at it. You know, there are those people that just have that incredible ability, you know, right off the bat, but creativity and art is not like that. You know, it really is something that shouldn't depend on rational thought. You know, because if it depended on rational thought, being an artist or being creative, it would have been destroyed completely by now rather than merely, you know, by society, because it's not rational, a lot of things that you do. Even the chalk festival wasn't rational from a business standpoint. But, you know, creativity is primarily a feature of, like, human intelligence. You know, it's a fundamental feature of the universe. So it's something that grows by, you know, out of passion and desire. And I don't know if that answered your question.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. And sadly, we are out of time. I just want to let everybody know we were speaking to Denise Cowell, the founder and creative director of the Chalk Festival. Denise, very quickly, tell our listeners how they can learn more about this.
It's best to go to our website, which is chalkfestival.org. Or you're welcome to go to our Facebook page, which is Sarasota Chalk Festival.
Awesome. That is tremendous. Thank you very much, Denise.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You too. Bye now.
All right, excellent. The chalk festivals I've been to are just breathtaking.
Yes, they are.
They got the Guinness Book of World Records.
That is just amazing.
And little did I know that when I was buying that chalk, that sidewalk chalk for my kids, that I was preparing them for a good career.
That's
you
right.
You know, you can make hundreds of thousands of dollars for, what she said, a few days worth of work.
A few days worth of work. Wow. Well, I know when my son for a while went through that little phase, my driveway was always adorned with all kinds of drawings.
Yeah, I wonder if some things we didn't have a chance to ask, or effect on humidity or rain or things like that, or if they do, if it makes a difference if it's horizontal kind of on a road versus vertical if it's on the side of a building.
You know, Steve, I mean, not to be negative, but you know, I mean, that's, you know, kind of, you know, asking somebody asks you, you know, what time it is, and you tell them how to build a watch. You know, it's just kind of the art is there, you know, and so. I think those details about how it actually works are really the question that I really wanted to ask her is, you know, to have her describe perhaps, you know, what she thought was maybe the most monumental chalk piece that she had seen, because that's I mean, she's seen all of them, and I think it's interesting that they aren't juried and that they get like 1,000 applications a year. I mean, to come to our little.
Down to Venice.
That's
unfortunately,
amazing.
Sarasota Burns Court has lost that. All right, well, let me just mention that the news and views here are not those of W.S. Lohr. It's board members, it's volunteers, employees, just the people that gave them, well, just of me. Take what you like and leave the rest. And after this show, we have Complex Waveforms with Mark Zimpella. Excellent show coming up. We've got some Miles Davis coming up in just a minute, so don't touch that dial. The background music you hear, the bumper music you hear in the background is original music produced by me. That's Steve Norris, written and produced by me. And we have lots of great shows coming up here at Fogartyville. Don't forget about that. If you missed any part of this show, you can hear it podcast at thesurrealnews.com. And we're also live streamed at WSLR.org. You can go there and live stream any place in the world to hear that. And, of course, we're on the air at 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida, your true community radio station. And this has been Surreal News, your news and public affairs. Next week, we have attorney Andrea Morgenstern coming in to talk to us about a lawsuit filed against Rick Scott and the cabinet for charging a violation of the Sunshine Law. You're listening to 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida, your true community radio station. And here's Miles Davis with Complex Waveforms and Mark Zampella. Thanks for tuning in. Have a great day. Enjoy this great music.